For those looking for a liberatory martial arts learning approach and curriculum, we've created Liberation Martial Arts. It doesn't just teach you martial arts, it's also an approach to learning movement skills. The whole point of our program is to remove the need for a coach, to liberate you from the need of top-down instruction and toxic gyms. If you have a coach and also have a gym, then you can apply our learning approach to improve your progress. Or maybe you also need a supplemental martial arts community as a counter to the commercial gym you go to. You can actually apply our learning approach to learn anything, and our practitioners are. They're applying it to all sorts of things, whether physical, mental, or even personal. It's just a radically different approach to everything. Sign up for Liberation Martial Arts at the Southpaw Pod Patreon, or support us by signing up for one of the other tiers, and help us support this project while also getting access to bonus content, like early releases of SDS9 with transcripts. SDS9 Season 3 was recorded from the beginning of 2023 to early 2024 and was first published on Patreon. Now that we're done with the season, the entire season is being released all at once on the Southpaw public feed. Find Season 4 on the Southpaw Pod Patreon. This is Southpaw Deep Space Nine Season 3.
What?
We made it. Where we analyze Deep Space Nine and Star Trek from a political and historical lens, episode by episode. I'm watching DS9 with fresh eyes, and Scott is our veteran Trek fan. We are discussing Season 3 of DS9, Episode 1, The Search, Part 1. Now, since this is a continuation of the Season 2 finale, we brought back historian and Trek fan, James Robinson. James, before Scott gives us the play-by-play, initial reactions to the rewatch of Part 1?
I think it calls into question some of the basic missions of Starfleet. And there's some politicking. I actually like one better than two overall.
Scott, can you tell us about this episode?
Yes. On Deep Space Nine, every time they do a simulation to see what'll happen, it shows that the Jem'Hadar could take over if they came over the wormhole. A ship comes in front of the Deep Space Nine. It is the new Defiance, and it has cloaking. This is new to the Federation. The Romulans are loaning the tech. They're getting along right now. They want to be ready for the Dominion. The Defiant is powerful. They want to take the Defiant to come to the Gamma Quadrant and talk to the Founders. Who are the Founders? Meet the Founders. Talk about it. This new security guy shows up to through Starfleet. His name is Eddington. And Odo is like, what the fuck? And they're like, we're going to be co-security buddies. Odo starts to think that it's an issue based on him being a changeling or whatever. And it's like, I'm going to log in my resignation. Jake and Ben have a nice meeting where they talk about the fact that they're accepting that this is their home. Kira wants Odo to come on the reconnaissance mission. And Odo just is looking longingly. We get emo Otto this episode. Kira and Otto are building their vibe. There's something going on. At least that's what I think. And then Ben wants Quark to come on the mission as he's done business with elements of the Dominion. And Ben has worked with the Grand Negus to have Quark come on the trip. And he was gifted the staff to borrow. And Quark kisses the staff. He kisses the ring, if you will. Dax and Sisko talk about the upcoming mission and recall old Dax. This is a thing that they do where they build their new friendship while also talking about their previous friendship. On the next day, the Defiant is ready to leave, and Odo decides to join the ship. They go through the wormhole at Warp 7, they cloak up, they put Quark and Odo together, they have a cute little tete-a-tete, and Odo starts feeling self-conscious as he has to revert, and he sort of projects as an anger so he can turn into the liquid form, because if he holds a shape for too long, he has to go back to his main form, which is liquid, which isn't foreshadowing at all. On the quadrant, they almost get caught, but they do some maneuvers to avoid it because the cloaking is like showing certain signs of energy. Science stuff. I didn't really understand it.
I didn't get it either.
Yeah. He's just like, trust me, it's science. They get to the Karema homeworld, and the team is going to get more information about the Dominion, and Quark uses his capitalism to get info. Ornithar says he mostly works with the Vorta, and if the Vorta are displeased, they send the Jem'Hadar. So like, it's like the Vorta play the good cop, and the Jem'Hadar play the bad cop, but secret guys, they're all bad when it comes to... Yeah, anyway, Ornithar and Quark are doing dealings. If Quark cancels the orders that they're doing dealings for, that could be fishy and get the Vorta and the Jem'Hadar mad. So they give him some information. So they're sent to an unmanned substate relay station in the Kalanon system, where they send info to the Dominion, where the founders and stuff. And still unclear where that all is. And we see Odo is moved by the Omarion Nebula, doing some emo navel gazing. And Kira's worried about Odo and him losing his constableship, that his devil may care attitude has been found problematic on the station. And they find coordinates of where the conversations have been going. So they go to the coordinates, Odo and Kira talk, and the Jem'Hadar attack, people are abducted, things happen. Kira awakens and she is with Odo approaching the Omarion Nebula. He's like, I gotta go. They found this rogue planet. They get there and it is filled with 90s CGI liquid. And out of the CGI liquid come people that look like Odo. A female changeling says, "Welcome home."
So loaning is basically licensing and intellectual property. So property ownership is very much a theme of DS9 and a source of conflict, which they constantly kind of, in a good way, reinforce. So they reinforce this theme in big ways and even little ways to say, like, this is always a thing here. This is like the crux of a lot of the problems. And even though it's the future and technology has changed a lot of things, a lot of old ideas still exist in the future in different ways. It's just new iterations, kind of like NFTs and AI, right? NFTs is a way to take things that everybody should be able to have, that should have like wide access, and then putting it behind a paywall and making people pay for something they should be able to get for free, right? AI is stealing other people's work and then not paying them for it. So these are all old ideas that's constantly a fixture of capitalism. And these are just new iterations. So the point then is, if you want to fight these things, don't just fight the new iterations, you got to fight capitalism. And this idea of new iterations and old ideas existing, I'm going to draw a through line because that keeps coming up in this episode. So we're in season 3, episode 1. And the show early on starts out straight up saying racial issue.
Yeah.
Sisko literally says that. And that is the theme of this episode, or at least one of the themes. And this is applied to Odo. Since Odo is the only one of his kind in this quadrant, he's the ultimate minority on DS9.
Yeah. I think that a lot of the episode is, you know, in times of war, the unknown, which is Odo, sort of gets pushed aside. You know, a lot of the episode underscores how he feels isolated and Starfleet just doesn't trust him. So they assigned this sort of swarmy dude to take over the Starfleet. And this is the second, I think in the first season, Odo had threatened to resign.
Yes.
Because he couldn't work the Starfleet regulations. And, you know, he's continued to bump heads, which is kind of funny to me that he wants more cop authority. And Starfleet's telling him, like, no, you actually can't do certain things. And he's like, I want total control of, you know, the I'm sure he wants to plant bugs on people. I don't know. You know, on this watch, I'm a little less sympathetic to Odo's cop duties.
Yeah. The thin goo line.
Yeah. and the, but on the other hand, the issues where he does feel like he's a total outsider. And then at the end of the episode, he's, whoa, his people, you know, he was drawn there almost like a salmon swimming upstream to their home. So, yeah, between Starfleet sort of displacing him and then this new kick-ass warship with this proprietary property, the cloaking device, you know, it draws in, well, Starfleet's working on stuff like that. Whoa, this is just purely a warship. This is purely just for fighting. There's nothing researchy about it.
Yep.
And, you know, I think they added that element because, you know, DS9, you can't, they have these runabouts, but you really need to add some kick ass into the show. And that's why the Defiant got put in.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I want to add to some of the things you're bringing up, not even like contradict, just add on top of it, because there's a lot going on in this episode. So there's like multiple readings, but there's like things happening in between things that are happening in between things. It's like a very multi-layered episode. It's multi-dimensional, I would say intersectional, even to the point that you brought up about Odo in season one or maybe season two, but part of the thing about butting heads with Starfleet about regulations, there's another added element to that, which is he felt undermined because they brought in somebody else to literally undermine him.
Right.
They brought in a Starfleet person. And I think that's important to remember for this episode, because right after that talk with Odo and Sisko about race, and this is not my reading, literally Sisko says racial issue, we go to a scene with Sisko and Jake talking about African art. So they're both humans, but they're also black. It's connecting the reality of race to the fictional character of Odo. So I don't think it's by accident, right? I think it was very intentional that you went from this to this scene, right? From that to this. With Odo, throughout the series, he's always good at reading between the lines. Since he's always been the outsider, he's learned to be observant. He has this third-party perspective, which we see when he's speaking to Kira. And in his conversations with Quark and throughout this episode, dignity is also a theme with Odo. And it's been a theme with him from the beginning of the series, but it's even more pronounced in this episode. You see through his trauma, the shame he's had to endure being himself. So he's forced to mask. And to some of the points you two have brought up, it's interesting how we read Odo as authoritarian, which there is that reading. But to the Federation and even Sisko, and perhaps maybe to the writers, he's the rebel. Again, the outsider. To quote Sisko, now this is textual, right? Odo is, quote, thumbing his nose at authority. His respect for the chain of command is minimal. Starfleet likes the chain of command, and frankly, so do I, end quote. So I think we have to recalibrate here, and I've tried to recalibrate several times watching this for the first time, because I've always heard about how people read him, and then I'm like, wait, just like going off of the text, it's a little bit more complicated than the way people have painted it, which is like much more black and white. Odo is neither Starfleet nor Bajoran. and this view of top-down chain of command authority, not just from Cisco, but from all the Starfleet members, will be important in this episode because they'll go along with a whole lot in the name of authority and following orders. And even just the assumption of good faith is a cause for concern. Like even with the Defiant, why are you just working on military tech, right? This doesn't sound very researchy. So Odo is the racialized militant minority who doesn't take orders. This isn't my interpretation. This is how it is in the text. The writers make an explicit scene about how Odo sees race as the motivating factor for his demotion, and no one wants to listen to him, right? And we've seen several examples so far of how Odo's life doesn't matter, right? Changeling life doesn't matter on DS9. He is othered. There's always been an acknowledgement of his minority status, and one of the first episodes of the series was racism against Odo. Here, they're saying Odo has too much attitude, which very much was an understood stereotype of Black people even in 90s writing. With this episode making a direct connection to Earth's history and Africa, right? You went from Odo to making a connection to Earth's history, Africa. You have two Black actors. Basically, how I read it, and going back to the theme of like old ideas still existing in the future, is saying racism still exists in the future, just new iterations. And so do a lot of tropes that come along with racism, right? This militant minority. That trope didn't go away. That racism didn't go away. Now it's on Odo instead of the Black father and son. A note to our listeners. If you love the Southpaw Project, please support us and help us get paid for our labor by financially supporting us on Patreon. This will give you access to exclusive bonus content, like early releases of Southpaw Deep Space Nine, our fictional narrative podcast, Fighter's Brew, break-free versions of our shows without interruptions like you're hearing now, bonus articles, Fighter's Brew transcripts with extra content, Liberation Martial Arts Online, as well as our private chat group on Discord. You can also make one-time donations at Ko-Fi or show your solidarity by wearing our swag. You can find all pertinent links at southpawpod.com. And I think there is an assumption that following Starfleet regulations is good, but we don't know that. I don't know that.
Right. And now following Starfleet means that we are now using cloaking weapons and amassing the armory. And this is sort of where Star Trek has, you know, going where no man has gone before. This is going where no Trek has gone before this, where like, ooh, this isn't about discovery. This is some war. This is war. And y'all are like, oh, well, since we're going to make this little excuse, this time it's going to be okay because this is about our enemy, but now we're about to use cloaking devices and yeah, like not use little runabouts, which are barely armed.
What do you guys make of that they take this heavily armed ship that has a ability to mask itself on a mission of peace to find, you know, the founders? They're trying to go to the central government to negotiate a peace. Is that how you do it? You show up heavily armed with the ability to cloak?
I actually wanted to bring up something you brought up in the season 2 finale, James, which is how you're like, you know, before this conflict, it was Starfleet and the Federation doing a lot of like antagonizing and breaking the rules first, right? So you can have a reading that says the Dominion are acting in self-defense. So I think this goes along with those observations you made where it's like, yeah, we're trying to do the right thing, but then are you really? Is that what you're doing here? Is this how you would do that, right?
Yeah, because it definitely goes against what you think. And like, you know, it's no secret that I relate a lot to Taoism and do a lot of reading. I'm like rereading the Tao Te Ching as translated by Ursula K. Le Guin. And, you know, she says, she interprets, the expert in warfare says, rather than dare make the attack, I'd take the attack. Rather than dare advance an inch, I'd retreat a foot. which is usually how we look at the Federation, or at least we think of the Federation and how we like our collective memories of what the Federation is. And at, even though I still think that the world that Trek exists in is a utopia that I'd be pretty excited to be in, but I'm like, I was misremembering a lot, and some of this stuff really conflicts with my ideology now.
Yeah, I think historians sometimes like look at the start of a war, right? The official date. And James, you can add to this, right? And sometimes when they do an analysis of it, kind of a forensics of it, they're like, yeah, that's the official date of the war, but you could actually say the war actually started a lot longer before this, right? And you could even say, even though this is like a mission of peace, this cloaked ship, you could actually say, no, this is part of the war. The war has already started. This is what you do in war. And so going back to regulations and Starfleet, right? Like I said, we don't know what they're doing is good, especially here. It's making it look really nebulous. And I think that's, again, intentional from the writers. And we all know also, right? Because not just within the text, but just from real life, just following orders doesn't mean justice. And the series has also has done episodes making that point. A lot of bad things can happen just following orders. And that also applies to Starfleet. Now, to change the tone of our discussion a little bit, I love when the Jem'Hadar show up with guns and the first reaction from them is to run at the DS9 crew and swing their guns instead of firing at them. And it reminds me of Armageddon Game. I think Scott brought this up when the armed soldiers show up to the lab and the scientists, when they see that these like murderous mercenaries show up with guns, their first reaction is, no guns here, please.
You know, it's funny because the Jem'Hadar are usually described as, you know, everything they do is lethal. Yet they shoot Kira right in the chest and like, I guess they have a stun setting because that didn't kill her.
Yeah. That's like another thing I noticed is like sometimes you would think they would have used a stun setting. Then you're like, oh, the character's dead. And then other times you're like, oh, why didn't they just kill that character? You're like, oh, no, it was a stun setting.
Plot armor.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. Now, since you both watched this when it first aired, what did you two think about the special effects then when you first watched it to how it looks to you now? Let me start with you, Scott, because you were already making allusions to that.
I really... and even more so episode two. I remember just being like, what's going to happen? When I watched it as a kid, I didn't think much of it. I was a kid. I was just like, I wasn't as into mythological television. So I was definitely like, oh, this is like connecting to the last season. What's going to happen? And I'm not going to lie. I don't remember it that well from the first time I watched it, and I remember it pretty well from the last time I did a rewatch, which was at the beginning of the quarantine of COVID-19. But even now, my politics have changed a lot, and on this rewatch, I'm like, I don't know about all this stuff. I'm having a harder time now. And, you know, from a mythological episode, I still give it like a 4 out of 5 because it is these two episodes are really significant in the scope of the story, but so these are not my favorite episodes. I think the writing did do a good job of conveying that things are changing. So in that way, I definitely noticed that in this watch. It's like, oh, the writing is doing a very good job of saying, oh, rules are changing. You know, once Terminator 2 came out in the 90s and that liquid metal thing came out, everything was compared to that and nothing was as good as that. We think that was the apex of special effects for a very long time.
I remember watching the Defiant battle, the Jem'Hadar, and just be like, whoa, this show just took a a pretty big turn where the ships are maneuvering. They're doing this sort of cannon phaser thing, and it blows up a ship, which they weren't able to do the previous season, defeat any Dominion. Now, in the last scene where the shapeshifters, so I thought that was pretty neat. I mean, yeah, it's obviously pretty CGI-ish, but, you know, it's this lake where all these changelings are coming out of. And the changeling, interestingly enough, they take humanoid form and they look like Odo. Yet, like, the explanation we've gotten up to that point of why Odo looks the way he does is he can't quite get the faces down. And so them looking like him sort of points to that they're imitating his look sort of to make him comfortable, I guess. And, you know, we can certainly go into that more in the next episode. Now, on the actual writing, I did like the Odo trying to figure out his place. There's also all these references to Sisko feeling like Bajor is his home now, especially when Jake says he's unboxing his African art. So it's gone from this is a temporary place, I want to get out of here as soon as I can, to this is a place I now belong. And I remember watching this for the first time, and it's almost like Star Trek Deep Space Nine feels very Cheers in space. you want to hang out with them all the time. This is your people. This is, you know, you're not warping all the way around, all over the place. You're building something larger in a single place. And yeah, now we have this element of this defiant ship, and maybe we have some new season regulars. Maybe we'll see this Michael Eddington clashing with Odo. Maybe we'll see this Romulan Taru, because she's going to supervise the cloaking device. So maybe we'll be seeing her lots more.
But you said you didn't like the writing so much because it was like Sisko making this his home.
No, I did like that. I thought the whole premise of sending a heavily armed ship on a diplomacy mission seemed a little off. Like, is that how diplomacy works? I mean, maybe that's gumboat diplomacy, to use the Teddy Roosevelt imperialist line. Like, and then sending Quark along with them is like, okay, that's a little contrived. Like, oh yeah, Quark's got to negotiate the Tulabury contract to get with the Calamar. I loved it when he forced him to kiss the Grand Nagus's cane. It's just like, oh man, mm-hmm. you're just like intentionally embarrassing Quark now.
But to the point James makes about Cheers and space is going to be really important in the next episode, because there is that theme, and that is something with Odo where it's like his family, his like biological family versus his found family. That's like going to be another theme. So,
and obviously mourn the character.
There you go.
Yeah. Norm.
Who's like literally supposed to be Norm from Cheers.
Yeah.
So since this is a two-parter, we're going to go right into part two. Now, if you haven't seen it and want to see it before you listen to us talk about it, pause the episode now. If you're like a lot of our fans who aren't even watching and just like listening to Scott give you the play-by-play and then us give the color commentary afterwards, then just keep listening. Because now we are discussing season 3 of DS9, episode 2, The Search, part 2. Scott, can you tell us about this episode?
So where we left off is that there are many changelings that are showing up, and Odo is there, and we find out that this planet, which as yet unnamed, is where Odo's from. Odo doesn't really remember being there. The female changeling says that at that time he was newly formed, and that's why he may not remember. And Odo says, is my family here? I'd like to meet my family. And they say, yeah, you have met your family. Everyone is family. We are all part of the Great Link, which is when all the changelings are connected. It's the Great Link. All that CGI liquid is a whole entire species. And Odo starts doing like the Odo thing, where it's like interrogating and just asking question after question after question. And Kira's like, stop being a cop. Just like, you've wanted this for so long. Chill out. And, you know, the Great Link is a collective. It's a connection. It's the opposite of Odo. Odo is very singular and ruggedly individual, and the Great Link is not. And Odo is home, and the leader, the female changeling, offers her hand, and they sort of morph into each other, and they have this sort of bond, this link. And Odo is changed. He's immediately changed. He says, I am home, and he shows joy, and maybe his rugged individualism is destroyed. And then we go to Sisko and Bashir, who are trying to get back home. It's not going well. Out of nowhere, O'Brien and Dax find them, and they're like, yo, things are happening at Deep Space Nine. And we find out that the changelings call non-changeling solids. They value isolation. They live on the planet. They've been, you know, they were treated unfairly for so long, and now they just like being their own thing. And Kira's trying to get out of the planet, but science is stopping her. Back on Deep Space Nine, the founders are there, and Borath of Vorta, who speaks for the Dominion, is there to talk and says that they're the founders, says that they accept it, says that they want to start the treaty. Garak is happy to see Bashir. Garak is worried about the Dominion Peace Treaty. He's doing that very Cardassian thing, like, I don't think this is going to be good, especially because the Romulans are being excluded from the treaty, which is not good for all the stuff, all the diplomacy. And then we see that Kira still can't get a signal. And again, there's a source interfering with all of it. And Odo is being challenged to be, like, turn into different things and be one with the things. And we find out that the founders apparently asked for the Romulans out of the peace treaty because they feel that they're going to do some stuff in the Federation and make some NATO-ass imperialists speak about the treaty. And they're like, Jesus, this is the right thing. We go back in the female changeling and Odo talk about their reasons for fear. And they sent many changelings out into the universe to learn of the universe and come back. Odo, they intimate that Odo has been gone for a long time, and he is the first to return, and they combine again. And Kira is talking to the forest because she doesn't know where Odo is, but she's really happy for him. And then she finds this like locked room building thingy. And back on Deep Space Nine, Quark is really happy for a peace treaty because it's good for business. And he does this, like, I have a dream where everyone can buy shit. You know, it's like almost getting to MLK, but obviously not getting there. Capitalism, sort of not dissimilar to when Jay-Z said, I'm Che Guevara with bling on. Like, what? he did. The Jemadar and Bashir have a bar fight. The new guy that's supposed to be Odo is like, we have to let it slide. Sisko at dinner is distracted. He finds that these closed door conversations are incorrect. He's dubious. And he hears that Dax is being transferred and Bashir is in the sick bay, and that the treaty will include that the Federation will leave the quadrant and Bajor will be looked over by the Dominion, and Sisko will be made captain. And the treaty has already been signed. So before you have anything to say, you don't have anything to say. And then we go back to Odo, who's finally had a significant morph as a vulture. And Odo's like, I'm going to stay. And Kira asks Odo, just like, help me find the door and get in there. Like, let's get into this building. And back to Deep Space Nine, Garak and Sisko agree that the treaty is going wrong. And they have this theoretical talk like, it would be terrible if we took shit over, right? And there's a scuffle on the promenade, and Garak helps Sisko, Dax, and Bashir go do something. Garak dies. They get on the Defiant, and they blast the wormhole. You're like, I don't know about all this. So, like, they've never done anything like this on the show before. Odo and Kira, they finally get to the building, and you see that all the people that we were talking about were like locked into like a VR sort of thing where they tied the team up to a machine to sort of test what would happen if they tried to create a treaty with the Federation. They're like, oh, they create trouble for them. They will. And we find out that the changelings are the founders, and they're like, they seek order. And they say, Odo, you'll understand soon. And Odo's like, don't try to mess with me. And they're like, oh, changelings don't hurt changelings. And Odo's like, I'm leaving. They let Odo and the team go. The team goes on the Defiant, but Odo's like, let me talk to the leader. And the leader, who we'll call the female changeling, tells Odo that if you leave, you will always be an outsider. And the leader goes back, the female changeling goes back into the link and tells Odo that he will miss this more. Do-do-do-do.
If you love the Southpaw Project, become one of our financial supporters. It'll help us supplement the cost of running this project, the incredible time and energy we put into it 7 days a week, and you'll be giving us some breathing room, not only to juggle Southpaw with our day jobs, but also to expand Southpaw into other areas. We can't exist without your contributions. Show your Southpaw solidarity by supporting us at southpawpod.com. Now, James, since you've watched part one and two now, again, what's your initial thoughts of The Search as a whole?
Yes, so I kind of hate episodes that where it ends with, it was all a dream, or it was just...
I fucking hate it.
It was just a holodeck thing. So watching this, I think watching it for the first time, I was like, wait, did they just really kill Garak? No, that's my favorite character. But that would have been a little ahead of its time to be killing characters left and right, like Game of Thrones style. So I hate that part of it. I do like where Odo's finally found his people, and I feel like that's the real strength of the episode, and he's exploring what it means. And then at the end, he has this horrible revelation about his heritage. What do you do when you find out that where you came from actually has some pretty sinister background? What do you do when you're exploring your own history and it's actually not something to be proud of? You know, why they formed the Dominion, they were persecuted, and then they become the persecutors. They formed this very fascist like entity to impose order. And you could say that they sent out all these baby changelings into the galaxy as scouts for later invasions. And they're surprised that Odo's back so soon, but they're happy to see him. Especially since the wormhole has opened up the possibility of imposing order on the other side of the galaxy. So there's that part. Honestly, it's hard for me to take the hologram stuff seriously at all. Just because it's like, okay, we have this sinister badmiral that is like doing this weird thing where they're going to crush the Romulans with the Dominions. Like, okay, wait a second. This is like, I know they're showing the dark side of the Federation in Deep Space Nine, but this is way out of bounds.
Yeah. I think it's another one of their thought experiment episodes mixed in with some of the other types of episodes that they do, or as Scott puts it, a mythological episode. So in this episode, we see Odo literally comes from a collective pool. And it's interesting that now he's such an individualist. I read it as individualism can be learned and is often a euphemism for isolation. But I could see also for Western mainstream audiences, this being read as individualism is what makes Odo good and strong and unique and what makes him do the right thing at the end. I like the point about how changing shape allows you to know another being. Empathy is about imagining yourself in someone else's shoes, whereas Odo can literally walk in someone else's shoes. And that hasn't been explored much yet in this series and in fiction in general. And I hope this series like does touch upon this more, because it is an idea that I haven't seen explored, I don't think, ever. So it's good that they brought it up, but I hope it wasn't just something they brought up in passing. But I guess I will see. But beings that have the ability to change shape is such a common thing to see in fantasy, sci-fi, or like even Marvel superhero stuff, but they never go into what all that entails, right? About gender to like, yeah, being able to live someone else's life, to all of those things. You could even say that about like possessions, or like when you body swap, or all those things. Doesn't explore a lot of those other things that are interesting, that could be explored, that is yet to be explored. And if the show is about exploration, those are other types of explorations one can do. Now, when the changelings say they don't trust solids, I don't know what the writers meant, but I take that as don't trust the Europeans. But this is where I began to get suspicious, because remember, this is my first watch, right? But at this point, this is where I started to get suspicious, because it reminded me of Disney Marvel writing, where I'm like, are we going to find out that this is just the baddies who make some valid points kind of story, right? Another thing that this episode highlighted is Odo is superhuman. We take that for granted, or we don't even recognize this, but he could turn into a bird. I didn't even know he could do that. And not only turn into it, he could actually fly. But we really didn't know this because A, the production budget, which we talked about before. So they're confined by material conditions. But also, Odo has been made to be ashamed of his superpowers. So rather than feeling proud, he hides in a literal bucket. It's fucked up. So I think that whole literal scene or literal thing that he does of going into a bucket and hiding there is also a great allegory for a lot of things that you can read into that. And then as far as changeling, that term being a derogatory term that Odo's people embraced and claimed as their own, is an interesting twist, because that happens, right? Oppressed people can sometimes do that. Oppressed groups can do that. Even like people who are members of political parties have done that. Oppressed political parties, like people who are fighting for independence or pro-democracy movements, have sometimes taken those type of terms and run with it. But this is where it gets more uncomfortable, because that is the reactionary fear, right? That the oppressed will become the new oppressors. And especially if this is like, you know, in the previous episode, right? I don't know if this is all intentional or even fully conscious, right? But there were allusions of like changeling experiences being very much like Black people experiences and like stereotypes, and even like claiming a word that was derogatory as your own, which was in the 90s, even more a topic that was being brought up, right? And then this is the storyline. So you make that connection, even bringing up African art, right? And then it's like, oh yeah, and that's how they become the new oppressors, and they're even worse than we were, kind of thing. I started getting real comfortable with that. And now in this simulation, right, this holodeck, this whole dream thing that James brought up, in it, it's all about the chain of command. And so, of course, Odo is the first one they have to remove. That makes sense, because you have to remove him to maintain the chain of command in his own way, right? He is like authoritarian, but also anti-authoritarian. he's complicated. He's goo, right? He's a changeling. He's not a solid thing, right? He's a lot of things at once, literally and metaphorically. But the Starfleet members, unlike Odo, will follow along with orders. And it's quite an indictment, but it stays consistent because they let Starfleet get pretty far with their fascism before they decide to do something. The other thing is, they believe Starfleet would do this, which is also very damning. But they also think Garak is an ally and someone they can trust. And he wasn't even part of the simulation as himself, right? He wasn't one of the people captured. So this was their interpretation of him, which I thought was interesting, right? Because as much as Sisko, as we've seen, has suspicions of him in his unconscious or subconscious, whatever framework you want to think of this as, he trusts him. Now, something James brought up. Blowing up the wormhole and deciding that that's your decision to make or your authority to make, you know, I don't know about that. Reminds me of the choice made by Kaio Paka to make a connection to previous episodes, where it's like, who are they, right? Who is Kaio Paka to make this decision? Who are they to make this decision, right? But they did, but, you know, doesn't have like huge consequences because it was just all a dream. But going back to the thought experiment thing, in this experiment, we kind of know where their head is at. But in the end, we do find out that this is the Hollywood convention of the oppressed villain. And we're decades past the 90s, and this convention has only gotten more popular. But, and I say this as someone who hasn't watched the rest of the series, the Dominion lie about everything. So who knows if the changelings were actually oppressed? That could be a lie. I don't know. I mean, I, as in literally me, I don't know. And I hope it is. In my opinion, the politics of this two-parter is messy, just like the changelings. But let me ask you both as Trek fans, since this series first aired, why has the oppressed villain trope gotten more popular since then? And why do so many people seem to take it as some radically good thing where it's like, oh yeah, this is the bad guy who kills a million people, but hey, look at their backstory, right? This is a win for liberatory politics.
I think we're seeing more of it because of the powers that be, quote unquote, you know, the corporations that make these things want to paint radicals as you know, radical solutions and alternatives to capitalism as like maniacs who will say this sort of rhetoric and then do these extreme things like kill a million people to get it because by any means necessary. It's like, well, I think that's actually you guys that do things like kill a million people.
Yeah.
So that's my theory on why that's become more popular. Now on the Dominion and their trope, yes, that is their like mythology.
That is their actual mythology. They were oppressed.
Yeah, that they were persecuted and all, but we do get the impression that that was like thousands of years ago. So they're clearly at the top, and by the time we get to this episode, they're clearly at the top of this like fascist, you know, opposite of the Federation, which is supposed to be this like socialistic utopian. So the Dominion rules by force. So they're the changelings, you know, they call the shots. They really, now a plot hole to me is that they put the interrogation room in the founder's home world. It's like, wouldn't you have that separate if you didn't want them to find it?
There's a lot of things about the plot of these two episodes you're not supposed to ask questions about.
I think that, you know, there used to be rules. So when comic books first came out, the comic books authority didn't allow you to write two-dimensional villains. Villains had to be just bad. And it's very easy when people are just bad to, one, get bored by it, and two, be like, oh, these are the good guys, these are the bad guys. When you create bad guys that oppress, but they have been oppressed, or they have a reason to, it draws you to them and makes you find pieces of connection to it. And, you know, eventually gets you to maybe even think, oh, they're not that bad anyway. Because through stories, you know, villains sometimes become the good guys. It's a pretty popular trope in 90s TV shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer or whatever, like these, you know, bad guys turn into the good guys. So, and then you have, then with the advent of the anti-hero, you know, we just get into rooting for villains, even though you realize like, oh, you're rooting for sociopaths and murderers and terrible. You know, case, a pretty good point is Tony Soprano. Like, you know, he was traumatized by his mother and growing up in violence, and you end up rooting for a terrible human being. So that's my 90 cents on it.
I guess we could say then capitalism creates like this cultural hegemony, right? It normalizes beliefs they want us to believe in and accept.
Mm-hmm. And I just want, so to like talk about like from a Trek thing, you know, again, I give this episode, like the last episode, a 4 because of its significance, but I really, really, really dislike It's All a Dream plot devices.
Explain that. Why?
Because I like things to matter. Even when a story is good, like, you know, in comic books, you have those what if comics in Marvel or Elseworlds in DC, where you like imagine this stuff, or, you know, there's like really incredible Red Sun Superman, where it's like, oh, what if Superman was, you know, landed in Russia? It's awesome, but it feels like it has lower stakes when it didn't happen.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, no, you two are right, because it's a two-parter, but really, like, what took place in here was like 20 minutes of actual stuff that actually happened, and then the rest of it was just like a dream. And then they're going to go back and be like, hey, we were in this dream.
Yeah, Starfleet's going to be like, so what happened in the dream? They're like, nothing substantial. We definitely didn't blow up the wormhole in the dream.
That would be a crazy idea to weaponize the wormhole.
Yeah.
What you just said lowers the stakes even more, because it's not only a dream, but it's a dream you can't tell anybody about because of the fucked up shit you did in the dream.
Yeah.
So everybody's going to have to act like, okay, everybody, let's just seal our lips. It's just all between us, right?
Yeah.
Whatever happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Yeah. Kira's on the way back. She's like, so what happened in the simulation? Anything that would have affected Bajor? I'm like, no, not nothing. Nothing.
That's kind of how the episode ended, right? Both of them were like Kira's side, Kira and Odo, and then Sisko, and those two parties were asking each other what happened, and they were both like, oh, we'll fill you in later.
Yeah. By the way, Odo's from a race of fascists.
Scott, I said that the politics of these two episodes were messy. I think James agreed on that. What did you think about that?
Oh, yeah, the politics are super messy because I'm just like, what are the politics?
That's the best question.
What are the points being made? I'm just, and also a lot of it is exposition. So I'm just, we've been introduced to the founders. We sort of have an idea of what they're about. We're going to find out more about them. Obviously, the Dominion is going to be significant in the show. The show is never going to be the same, and that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, and you know, expanding on what you said earlier, Scott, this is an important episode in the overall scheme of things, because it does establish, you know, some structures of the Dominion, how they act, and, you know, it does set up this what'll be this ongoing Cold War between these two superpowers.
I will point out, though, as messy as the politics and even some of the writing is, I thought the acting was fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe for the audience, it's low stakes, so it's like, why are we watching this? But for the actors, because it is low stakes and it doesn't really matter, they were able to even go further with their acting and be like, yeah, I could do stuff. I could be more adventurous with my acting because this isn't going to be part of the canon.
Yeah. going back to the CGI goo thing for a second, whenever Odo links with the female changeling in this episode, I'm like, are they having sex right now?
Sort of.
What's going on?
Like, it's not sexual, but I don't, but it's like, it's sensual. I don't know.
Like, they're morphing thoughts and feelings, and it's just like, I guess that's the equivalent. It's not reproductive. It's definitely social, which sex is too. But when I'm watching that, I'm like, is this pornographic?
But I definitely got similar vibes from the female changeling, who was kind of like a proxy for like the queen of this hive and the Borg queen. There's even kind of like their kind of humanoidness, right? And their sensuality and even like the importance of that touch. This was before, I think, that movie, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was.
So, you know, I could see how like this was kind of like a first run at this kind of character and idea. And then they ran with it and did something even more scary and ominous with the Borg Queen. So this is kind of like a primordial ooze version of that later Borg Queen, I feel like. So I like these kind of connections where you see like characters or ideas that are incepted and tested out in like a previous episode or a different series, and then you see it done again later on in a movie or another series. I guess that's kind of the fun of Star Trek, right? You watch all of it, right? And then you can see even like connections between the different franchises. Any parting thoughts from either one of you?
I think that Deep Space Nine does just take a pretty different tone. A lot of it's similar, but it really takes off from here.
So are you saying like the DS9 that fans really love and talk about, season 3 is like when it really starts?
I think so.
All right, Scott, can you tell us about the next episode?
So the next episode is called House of Quark. I have a feeling we're going to learn a little bit about Quark.
Until then, if you like this episode and like what we do, support us on Patreon. We also have the Liberation Martial Arts program if you want to train with us from wherever you are. It's both theory and practice and removes the need for an instructor. What you're learning is how to teach yourself. It's also an approach you can take with you from the gym into the world. Sponsors get a monthly training session with me, either in person or online. Supporting me not only helps me pay my bills, but it also helps me support my family. Find all our links, including Southpaw merch, at southpawpod.com.